You're listening to the Liberty Grace Church Sermon Podcast. For more information, visit libertygrace.ca.
Welcome to the sixth sermon as we look at the book of Ecclesiastes. And this is a book of wisdom, which means it's really geared to tell us how to live wisely. Wisdom is not something that's abstract. It's not like, oh, somebody's really smart. It's more skillful. It's the idea of this guy really knows how to live. They've mastered the art of living well in this world. And some of the books of wisdom are a little bit different. And so Proverbs is more generally speaking, these are principles to follow. And if you follow them, life will go well. Solomon, the Song of Solomon is a book of love and celebrates human sex. And so if you're thinking the Bible has nothing to say about sex or it's all negative about sex, there's a whole book of the Bible that celebrates sexuality and the beauty of that. And Job is about suffering. And Ecclesiastes is really about how do we make sense of how brutal life is sometimes? How do we live wisely in a world that it just seems like life is crazy a lot of the time? I was up by near Steffi's on Clinton Street. I wasn't visiting Steffi, but I was on Clinton Street north of college, and I saw this home. And first sign I had that I knew what I was going to see was like Holmes. You remember Mike Holmes had the show Homes on Homes, and he had a sign out there, Homes Approved Contractor. I looked over all the fences, and there was a beautiful house, completely stripped all the way in the inside, completely gutted all the way to the walls. And I looked at that. I knew Holmes is always like, oh, like, rip it all out. Like, it all has to go. We need to start from scratch. And it almost feels like Ecclesiastes is like that. Looking at our lives and just saying, okay, let's take it back to the walls. Let's strip away everything that doesn't work and see if we can rebuild it the way it should have been rebuilt in the first place. And so it's a little bit brutal. We've been looking at it, and Ecclesiastes is a little bit brutal because it's like, would you stop knocking down walls in my life? Would you stop tearing down every aspect of my life? Would you stop being negative? But his goal is not just to strip us back, but to actually rebuild. And today is going to be the greatest example of that. He's going to strip back some more things. In fact, three things that don't work. And then he's going to begin, I think, rebuilding our lives in a beautiful way. And so we're getting towards the end of Ecclesiastes. He's going to start to wrap up. And in this passage, you get the strongest note of hope so far in this book. So let's be prepared. He's going to strip some things away, and then he's going to give you a key contribution to rebuild today. So what's got to be stripped from your life? Three ideas. And here's the first. Life should be fair. Where we get this from, we didn't read it, but in chapter 8, this is basically what he deals with. He deals with the idea that we think life should be fair. So here's what we tend to think. Good people should get ahead. Bad people should suffer. Life should be basically a meritocracy where if you're a good person, if you do good things, if you're loving, life should go well for you. And if you're a bad person and you're mean, then bad things should happen to you. Or if you want to take it a different way, if you go to Amazon, if you download any number of books, or if I could point you to blog posts, and it basically says, here's how you live successfully. And if you follow these principles, you will have a good life. If you want to mess up your life, there's also books about that. Follow these principles and you will muck up your life, guaranteed. The problem is, if you live this way, you're going to be very confused, because sometimes good people suffer. Sometimes bad people get ahead. Many times life seems unfair. And so in chapter 8, he gives us three examples to basically say, hey, I want to strip away from your life the understanding that life should be fair. And so verses 1-9, he talks about how to relate to kings. And you're like, okay, big deal. We don't have a king. Really good principles for how to deal with anybody who is in authority over you. You know, verse 2, for instance, says, keep the king's command because of God's oath to him. So this applies to kings, also really applies to anybody over you. Like if you have a boss, generally do what the boss says. If you want to live a good life, that's just part of living skillfully. Anybody who's in authority over you, basically follow what they say. It's just common sense. Be obedient and it will go well, generally speaking. But you go down to verses 6 to 8, and in the middle of this, he even in this principle he gives, he says in verse 6, there is a time and a way for everything, although man's trouble lies heavily on him, for he does not know what is to be, and who can tell him how it will be? No man has the power to retain the spirit or power over the day of death. There is no discharge from war, nor will wickedness deliver those who are given to it. And so what is he saying here? Rules say, if you are a good employee, you will get ahead in your career. But then he goes on and says, but just a caveat, nobody knows when the next recession will hit. Nobody knows when your business will be shut down. Nobody knows when war will break out. Basically life is uncertain. Don't think that you, just because you're doing it right, that you're necessarily going to get ahead. Verses 10 to 13, he gives a second example. He talks about a wicked person buried. That is a day for rejoicing, right? When a wicked person dies, generally speaking, it's like we're glad. I mean, not that we want to be vindictive, but when a dead person dies, it's like it's a win. But he goes on and he says, this wicked person used to go in and out of the holy place and were praised. And you're like, okay, hold on. A wicked person dies, but this wicked person was religious. And this wicked person was actually praised by people. And all of a sudden you're thinking, what gives? Like, how can a wicked person be religious and be popular? And then it goes on and says, this also is vanity, meaningless, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, and the heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil. And here's what he's saying, like sometimes bad people get away with stuff. And also the heart of people is too easy. Like we go along with evil people. We're fully set to do evil. We have a problem in life. And so what he's saying here is, look, sometimes bad people get ahead and they're actually praised and they're religious. They come across as if they're godly and people are like, what an amazing person, even though they're wicked. And he says, he goes on to say, you know, it's just not fair. Next example, verses 14 to 17, he basically gives the example that sometimes good people get what the wicked deserve and wicked people get what good people deserve. It's really inexplicable. It's not fair. He says, you know, it just doesn't make sense. There are righteous people, verse 14, to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. They do everything right and they have nothing but problems. And there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. And I also said that this is vanity. Guys, please hear this. The Bible says we need to understand life is not fair. In the long run, God is going to settle every score. In the long run, things will be corrected. But in this life, never be surprised that trouble comes your way, even when you do everything right. Don't be surprised by suffering. Don't ever think. You just need to get rid of the idea that life is fair. On the other hand, I just want to speak to you today. If there's anybody here who's getting ahead in life right now, and you're like, woo, my life is amazing. God's blessing is on my life. Never mistake circumstantial evidence as signs of God's blessing. Sometimes people get ahead and it has nothing to do with God's blessing. We live in a broken world. Never think, never equate that you can follow a formula and that life will work out according to it, because life is not fair. Okay, so the next lie he wants us to get rid of is the idea that we can treat death like it's not a problem. Verses, chapter 9 and verses 1 to 6, he's like, okay, let me just strip this back from your life. That life is not a problem, or death is not a problem. That we all know we're going to die, right? The problem is that all of us essentially ignore this fact as long as we can. And in verses 1-6, he's like, hey guys, I just want to bring this up again. You will die. So we all know it, but we all deny it. 100 years from now, as Anne Lamott says, all new people. If you think of that, 100 years from now, probably not one person who's alive will exist and still be alive on that day. And he goes on, he says in verse one, he says, I just wanted to examine this. Man does not know, he says at the end of verse one, both are before him. It's the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked. It doesn't matter who you are, you're going to die. And he goes on and he says, basically all of this equalizes thing. It doesn't matter how you live, in a sense, we're all going to die. And he goes on and he says, in verse four, he who is joined with all the living has hope. In other words, the worst person who's alive from a human sense, apart from God, is better than the best person who's dead. And to emphasize this, he goes on, and we kind of lose this today. A living dog, if we think of dogs as being amazing, which they are, okay, they are. But back then, they would have been seen kind of like we see raccoons. It would be like the thing that raids your garbage can at night. And you're like, stupid thing. I just wish they were all gone. They're kind of cute when they're babies, but they're annoying as anything when they get older. And what he says here is basically a living dog, like a raccoon, raiding your green bin is better than a dead lion. The lowliest creature alive is better than the most majestic creature dead. And here what he's saying is, this is, if there's ever something we need to hear in Liberty Village, it's this. We live in a very death-denying culture, right? Where we all know it's real, but we pretend it's not real. And we do everything we can to prolong our lives and pretend that they're going to be everlasting. And even when I go to funerals, I'm often depressed. And the reason I'm depressed at funerals isn't just that somebody's died. Funerals should be depressing. We were meant to mourn at funerals. The reason why I get depressed at funerals is even at funerals, they're denying the reality of what happened. I've been to funerals where it's been forbidden to cry. It's like, we just need to rejoice. You know, we need to be happy that this person lived a good life. And what Ecclesiastes is saying is, please don't deny the ugly reality of death. To quote, just please don't ever think you can put lipstick on death and say it's no big deal. Never say it's just part of life. You know, it's just part of the circle of life, that death is no big deal. It's just another thing. It is ugly and it is coming for all of us. As theologian D.A. Carson said, death is an enemy. And it can be a fierce one. Not quoting him, you cannot stand by a casket and think that death is okay. I dare you to stand by a casket, honestly, of a loved one that you've lost, doesn't matter how old or young, and say that this is okay. This person, like this is good. It's like, it is ugly. Continuing with Carson, it says, death destroys relationships. It's ugly. It is to be feared. It is repulsive. There is something odious about death. Never pretend otherwise. If you have the belief that death is no big deal, you don't have a Christian view of death. Death is a very big deal. Death is the last enemy to be defeated. It is the reason, one of the key reasons why Jesus came to defeat death. It's our enemy. And so verses 1-6 basically say, hey, please don't ever think. I just want to strip this idea away from your life that death is not a big deal. It is a daily reality that all of us should think about because it's coming for all of us and it will rob you of everything you have. And we've all got to deal with that harsh reality. Final lie in the end of chapter 9, the final thing he wants to strip us away from is the idea that you can predict how your life will go. So he's tried to strip us of the idea that life is fair. He's tried to strip us of the idea that, you know, we don't have to worry about death. In verses 11 to 18, he says, essentially, I want to strip you of the idea that you can plan your life, that you can basically map it out. You know, then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to have kids, and then I'm going to, spend this many years with a kid, then I'm going to resume my career, and then I'm going to, you know, one day accumulate this much money, and then I'm going to retire. He says in verses 11 to 18, life doesn't work like that. You are not in control. There's no guarantees of how your life will turn out. You have no idea how tomorrow will turn out. You don't even know what the rest of the day will bring. You have no control. You can't predict how your life is going to go. All it takes is one bad person to ruin all your efforts, or one uncontrollable event. Verses 11 to 12, he says, I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift. So the swift person runs, right? The fastest person in this race, I'm going to win. Clearly I'm faster than everybody. And he's like, you don't know you're going to win. It's not just a matter of you being fast. You can't presume how the race will go. Sometimes it's not just the fast people who win the race, nor the battle to the strong. So many battles. The weakest party won, nor the bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those who have knowledge, but time and chance happen to them all. You know, when you read a business book, here's how I built my business. The guy who wrote the Pixar one, he actually included a chapter and he says, you know, here's all the ways that I built my business. Here's all the things. And I really appreciate it. In the chapter, he basically said, and time and chance helped a lot. I got lucky. You know, basically what he's saying is there's no formula, right? You can't plan it out. You need the X factor. You need luck. You need luck to be on your side, and none of us can control that. It goes on, man does not know his time, like fish that are taken in an evil net and vines that are caught in a snare. So the children of men are snared at an evil time when it falls suddenly on them. Little fish swimming along, right? All of a sudden it's like, what's going on? And caught up in a net. Totally out of his control. Life is like that. You and I have very little control over how our life will go. I told you this was going to hurt. What he's doing here is he's Mike Holmes hammering down the things that need to go from our lives. He's stripping us of the things that really prop up our lives that are false. Please never think that life is fair. Please never think that death is not a problem for you. It is. Please never think that you can predict how tomorrow will go. Please don't think you can map out your life and it's going to go that way. If you believe any of these lies, you're setting yourself up for a whole host of problems. You know what he's saying here is essentially, a lot of us want to pretend that we live in a Genesis 2 world. We want to pretend that we still live in when life was good. Genesis 2 is before sin. We want to pretend like the curse hasn't happened and we can control life. The reality is we live in a Genesis 3 world. In Genesis 3, sin entered the world. Everything went south. We were exiled from Eden. We now live outside of the way the world was meant to be. We live in the middle of chaos. Never think you live in a Genesis 2 world. We live in a Genesis 3 world, and we'd better adjust if we're going to understand it. Okay, remember that house on Clinton Street? Imagine if the builders knocked down all the walls, got it, you know, like we're done. And the homeowner came and they're like, they're taking down the boards around the house. And the homeowner's like, what are you doing? I can't live in this. Well, we're about to experience it. We know what this is like, right? It almost feels like the preacher is taking everything away and we're like, hey, what are we supposed to do? Like, are we supposed to leave here depressed and thinking about our death? And no, what he's trying to do is to begin to rebuild. We're going to see in the coming weeks, he gives us, I think we've got 2 weeks left. Is that right? I can't keep track. I think it's 2 weeks left. Thank you, Steffi. You know, he's trying to begin to rebuild us so that we can know how to live in a beautiful way in this broken world. And I want you to soak in every word that Chantel read for us in Ecclesiastes 9, 7 to 12. And I mean this, I'm going to read it slowly. I want you to think about this in light of what he said here today, because this is him basically saying, I've knocked all the walls down. Let me begin to rebuild something that you can live in. Ecclesiastes 9, verse 7, go eat your bread with joy. Drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy a life with the wife whom you love, all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For there is no work or thought of knowledge or wisdom in Sheol, which is a place of death in the Hebrew worldview to which you are going. And so what's he saying here? This is, I think, the six, basically carpe diem statement in the book of Ecclesiastes. He keeps on saying, hey, life is hard. And then he keeps giving these glimmers of hope. This is the strongest one so far. And here's what he's saying. Live your life. Like tonight, when you go home, if you're eating dinner tonight, if you're pulling out a frozen dinner from the microwave, throw it out. Open up your Uber Eats app. Look for something that's rated 4.9. Order it in. Open a nice bottle of wine. Light a candle and enjoy that meal. Verse 8, he basically says, okay, if you have stuff in your closet that you bought on sale and it's practical and you hate it, find a donation bin and give it away. Go out. This week is Black Friday. Buy yourself some clothes that make you feel good and wear them. Verse 9, this is in the Bible, guys. Verse 9, if you are married, enjoy that marriage. Whatever it is, verse 10, that your hand finds to do, don't sleepwalk through life. You only have a limited time to live. Live it with all that you've got, because when life is over, it will be too late to enjoy it. What he's saying, he's not negating what he said so far. He's saying life is hard and brutal and we can't count on anything. And so he's like, in light of the fact that right now, all you have is a present, make the most out of every moment that you have. Enjoy, instead of complaining that life is short and unpredictable, enjoy every moment. Savor your food, wear clothes you love. Do these for God's glory. You know, if you've been on vacation, all of us have, you go to a hotel, there's really two ways you can do it. You can go to a hotel and you can go, I am so tired. This vacation's only a week. Like in a week, I'm just going to be back at work and I'm going to be running all over the place. This vacation is going to go by sooner than I think. It's over. It's vanity. So therefore, I'm not going to enjoy it, right? It's because it's going to be over. It won't last. I don't even know how the vacation will go. Maybe the buffet won't be good tomorrow. So that's option number one of how you can have that vacation. Option number two is to say, this vacation is short. I better make the best of it I can. I don't know how things are going to go, but I better squeeze every ounce of enjoyment out of it, because I don't know how many good days of vacation there will be. I am going to enjoy every moment. And so, biblical worldview here, ride a bike, see the Grand Canyon in person, go to the theater, learn to make music, visit sick people and care for them, care for the dying, cook a meal, learn how to cook a very good meal, feed the hungry, watch a film, read a book, laugh with friends until it makes you cry, play football, run a marathon, snorkel in the ocean, listen to Mozart, phone your parents, write a letter, a handwritten letter, play with your kids, spend your money, learn a new language, plant a church, start a school, speak about Jesus, travel somewhere where you've never been before, pretend you're Andre and become an Instagram star, adopt a child, give away your fortune, and then make some more and give that away too. Shape someone else's life by laying down your own. Enjoy all of God's good gifts, knowing that time is short. That is true Christianity. And the reason we can do this in part is, although we live in a Genesis 3 world, we can know that we're living in a Revelation 21 world. You know, what's interesting in this passage, he says God already approves of God already approves of all that you're doing. When you understand, friends, when God is for you, when you understand that Jesus is for you, which every believer in Jesus Christ can know, God is for me, it frees you, even in the brutality of life, to live with freedom and enjoy every moment, especially knowing that God is going to set everything right one day. Jesus died to undo the damage that sin did in this broken world. When you know Jesus, you can find hope and enjoy life even when it's short and uncertain. And so friends, if you hear nothing else, Ecclesiastes is going to say more on how to do this, but hear this tonight. Accept the harsh realities of a broken world. And as you do, urgently enjoy every good gift that God gives you, especially because of the hope that we have in Jesus. And so, Lord, in this hard life, nobody can deny that life is hard. In the middle, though, of all these harsh realities of life, help us to enjoy every good gift that you've given us as we look forward to the day when everything sad will come untrue. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.